Welcome back, everyone. This is Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. I'm Melinda Wittstock. We're talking about openness and transparency in Virginia government. And our guest with us tonight, Megan Ryan, she's an advocate for open government, and Ginger Stanley from the Virginia Press Association. And we also want to hear more from you. So please call us at 1-866-611-NEWS. That's 1-866-611-6397. We have been talking about all range of issues here in the first half hour of the show, and we want to dig a little bit deeper into some of those as we look at some recent House bills that might have limited our right to know and other efforts that might enhance our right to know. Megan, of the legislative session so far, what are your biggest takeaways as we look at the effort, your effort in particular, to try and increase transparency and openness in government?
We have many of the same bills. We follow many of the same bills that the Press Association follows, bills that do affect the Freedom of Information Act, as well as some of the other issues that you brought up, the concealed handgun permits, as well as the publication of public notices in newspapers. We also try to follow bills that would proactively disclose information and or otherwise try to make things more transparent, whether that is requiring the publication of an organizational chart of government, whether it's efforts to try to record subcommittee and committee meetings and make those recordings available as an archive on the Division of Legislative Information Services website, or we're also following budget issues in terms of trying to get the budget available for the public to review prior to a vote on it so that they can participate in the conversation about what the final budget that will be passed.
How much of a clamor is there among the public to actually get their hands on the budget?
Well, we hear it every year. We hear from all kinds of people who, like Mark, who called earlier, might have electronic-only publications. They might be single individuals who have these hyper-local news sources, and they want to be able to participate in the process. They don't have the staff. They don't have the resources. So that they do, if they had the time to see what might be coming out from the budget, they have their own perspectives. They can write stories. They can get news out to some of their supporters. Some of these hyperlocal, are also very advocacy minded, and to get it out to their audience. And every year we hear from people who say that they were shut out of the actual meeting process, and people who want to be there for, like I said earlier, people want to know for a lot of different reasons.
When folks do get shut out of the process, as you're describing, what kind of recourse do they have?
Well, the Virginia law does say that, as Ginger mentioned, that you can be fined upwards of $5,000 for subsequent violations. In all reality, it doesn't happen very often. There have been more FOIA cases, as Ginger mentioned, but there are a lot of, at least from on the public's level, there are a lot of people who just cannot afford to do it. I know that the press has a less expansive budget than they once had to pursue cases, and then on the citizen side, we have people who just don't have the time, or the money, or anything else to pursue any kind of recourse. We have long advocated for, or just in general, thought that it was a good idea if the Freedom of Information Advisory Council had some sort of ability to moderate disputes rather than just provide excellent advice, which they do in interpreting the Freedom of Information Act. We have long thought that they should also have some authority to mediate disputes so that there is an alternative to going to court.
You know, Ginger, with so many websites out there and the social media and empowerment of citizens to really take matters into their own hands and become, in effect, citizen journalists, how is that dynamic changing the process here? Are you noticing a change that more citizens are just taking matters into their own hands? Or do they still need professional accredited journalists to go do that work?
The citizen journalists, and there are several organizations on a national level devoted to helping citizens become solvent and able to do this, because it is not a very lucrative profession at this time. I think it is a positive that we are seeing, because it is giving citizens who really do care about government and what is happening an opportunity to have a voice, and not just what we consider the mainstream journalist. So I see it as productive, especially from the standpoint of citizens learning that they have more rights and responsibilities to be a part of their government. So it's helpful in the sense that it gets more word out. I'm not sure that it is always the most informed story that you're going to see on some of these sites. You still need that investigative journalist who is trained to go after this type of information, but I do believe there is a place for both.
It seems that a lot of people want to be able to contribute, but they don't necessarily want to be full-time journalists. But if there was a way to be able to take a lot of, say, raw data and just organize it in a way that was more user-friendly, do either of you have a perspective about what some other states are doing to be able to, in the federal government, for instance, with the President Obama's initiative, data.gov, that's a mouthful, to allow people to really look for the data, easily search it, report things, data reported in plain English for people to easily understand? What does technology afford us? And are there any other examples out there that Virginia could learn from?
Well, Virginia actually does have a very good example of something that's done that, and that is the Virginia Public Access Project. VPAP took publicly available data related to campaign finance and campaign disclosure forms, lobbyist registration, and more, and they have sliced and diced that data and put it together in a very user-friendly and just interesting, visually interesting package that can really help people understand who's contributing money to campaigns, who one person might have contributed to. You know, one person is contributing to several different candidates. Who are those candidates? As well as whose campaign is receiving donations from, you know, which sources. And so they do an excellent job of that. And I know that was what the impetus was behind Virginia Decoded, which is a product of Waldo Jaquith, who was once on our board. He had to step down to take a job with the White House, which I guess I can forgive him for. But he is also taking the raw data that is the Virginia Code and trying to make it more usable so that you can cross-reference easier. You can look up court cases that interpret sections. You can look up the history of a particular section. So there's probably a lot of room for that. I think anytime you make databases available, that you unleash a lot of potential for innovation. People can use that information to try to make, as on the data.gov example, I know that one of the examples that was used when that came out was they had made information about child car seat safety ranking them, as well as special issues with each type of car seat. They made that database available, and some people developed a smartphone or an iPad application that would let people sort of tap in, you know, here's my seat, and what do I do? What are the safety issues on it? And so there are all kinds of ways that innovative people can use data to help the general public.
We've seen a lot of that around money and politics federally with, say, an organization like OpenSecrets.org, which is very, very helpful as a journalist in all my years covering the U.S. Congress, for instance, to be able to understand what the money was behind, perhaps, the vote. Ginger, are these sort of databases very helpful for journalists? I imagine they are.
They are, and the Virginia Project that Megan spoke of actually was started by the major newspapers in Virginia, because the State Board of Elections were not very automated at that time. It was very difficult to see what was being sent to them in the form of data, and so newspapers use that not only to follow the money, but also to understand redistricting. That was a great feature on VPAP this past year, is to see how the redistricting occurred and why the changes happened. And that was easy. If you followed the money and you looked at the dollars that were being contributed to the various campaigns around the state, you could see who was being targeted. And then you could also relate that to the way that our districts are divided, both senatorially and in the House.
You're listening to Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. We're talking about openness and transparency in state government here in Virginia. And I'm Melinda Wittstock, and we're really hoping that if you have a burning question or any opinion about how open the Virginia government is or should be, we'd really like to hear from you. Please call us. We're at 1-866-611-NEWS. That's 1-866-611-6397. 866-611-6397. Here with me in the studio, Megan Ryan. She is an advocate of openness in government with the Virginia Coalition on Open Government. And also with us, Ginger Stanley from the Virginia Press Association. Well, one of the things that strikes me in this year, with another election coming up and a lot of contentiousness around voting machines and transparency or lack thereof in the voting machines, very difficult to see what actually happened in those voting machines, controversies over potential suppression of the vote. If it's close, what are your concerns in Virginia around public access and right to know around voting registration and around the actual vote? Megan, I'll go to you first on that.
Well, the Virginia Coalition for Open Government has signed on to a friend of the court brief that there's a court case going on now in the Fourth Circuit. It's appealing a Norfolk district judge's decision that said that it was not under the Freedom of Information Act. It was decided under a different federal law. But the Norfolk court said that people should be able to see the rejected voter applications, voter registration applications. And we have supported that ruling as part and parcel of the overall transparency in government, because people, in the particular case, the plaintiffs in the case were Norfolk State students who had written down the general address of Norfolk State rather than their specific PO boxes or something like that, and their applications were rejected for that reason. They suspected that they were rejected for other reasons. We did not actually, get involved in the specifics of the case, but as I said, we filed a friend of the court brief, which allows us to take a policy position that says that in order to, to make sure that the right people are getting registered and that the right people aren't getting I mean, that people who otherwise meet the criteria are not wrongly kept out of the process. We want to be able to make sure that that's happening. And if I may go back to just briefly on the concealed handgun permit bill, it's a similar argument that we have for that bill, in that if when the government is regulating a particular area like that and they're licensing handguns, or if they're deciding who gets to vote and who doesn't get to vote, we want to make sure that the process that they're using to do that is as transparent as possible.
Yeah, it's hard to object to something if you don't know why you've been rejected. Ginger, what's your perspective on this? And what do you foresee any big battles looming as we head to November?
Well, Melinda, that's what I've been doing all day. Is first this morning I was in the House Privileges and Elections Subcommittee, and this evening, just before joining you, I was in the Senate Privileges and Elections Full Committee. And the big issue at this moment is all about provisional ballots and who is having to use that as opposed to just a regular voting ballot, who can see the process of counting those provisional ballots. And so there has been and will probably continue to be for the next several days great debate on both the House and Senate floor as to when you vote, what type of identification you need to have, and if you don't have the proper identification, what type of ballot you're given. So that is happening right now in Richmond at 9th and Broad Street, and will go on for, I'm sure, the next 2 weeks.
I'm sure it will, and perhaps the debate beyond that, too. We've got Liza on the line from Wyethville. Liza, welcome.
For taking my call. I have a kind of complex question about Virginia politics. It's not about lobbyists, but some of the consulting companies, it seems like a huge conflict of interest. A friend of mine from college days works for Ralph Reed, and he has a huge hand, Ralph does, in Virginia politics. He advises Governor McDonnell, Ken Cuccinelli, his partner, Tim Phillips, who's on the Coke industry payroll. Tim is the advisor for Bob Goodlatte, a congressman down in the Roanoke area. And at the same time, I don't know if you know who Ralph is, but he started the Christian Coalition back in the late 80s, I think. And so he has a huge Christian network of contacts, and he went into business for himself, but he still uses these contacts, including Liberty. He was great buddies with Jerry Falwell. So Liberty University, Regent, and then he has corporate clients. So he uses the Christian networks, according to my friend. It's a big, very lucrative business for them. They get out the vote. He ran George W. Bush's reelection campaign in 2004, largely through Christian groups. And they now have the Faith and Freedom Coalition.
So, Liza, are you saying that this isn't transparent information?
Yeah, I don't feel like it's transparent. And the reason is their corporations include a lot of big energy, you know, the Koch brothers and timber interests and so forth. And I feel like that should be transparent. If a politician has a consultant who's working for these big corporations who oppose any kind of regulation, of course, and climate action, that's their number one objective, is to cast doubt on climate science. I feel like, and we can't know, you know, those, technically they're supposed to be confidential, who those clients are. But I know, just because, I mean, some of that has already gotten leaked out anyhow, but I know from my friend that those are their interests. And this is being forwarded through Virginia politics and, of course, national politics. They have many, many legislators that they consult for. And money flows. You know, money flows to the super PAC.
Well, money definitely talks in these cases, and it's certainly there. I mean, on the Megan, to you on this issue of disclosure, and also potential conflicts of interest. I mean, what is the Virginia law on that, and how can it be improved?
Our position on disclosure is that we, while on campaign finances, Whatever the legislature or the or Congress or whatever the law is as to what constitutes a conflict of interest, what must be reported, what must be disclosed, we don't get involved in the details of what would be something that has to be reported, how much of a gift or how much of a contribution. But if those contributions and gifts are made, then we do feel like they need to be whichever ones they have decided. I'm not sure if I'm putting this right, but that they do need to be disclosed. We do not actually get involved in the actual determinations of what is considered a conflict of interest and whether or not something should be a conflict of interest. If the information is available, and then Virginia, again, through the Virginia Public Access Project, you do have a mechanism to see a lot of this influence. And then it's up to you to decide whether it's an improper influence or whether it is, whether it's money in and it's because just people need that extra money, but they are staying true to their principles. Maybe there are people who do that and maybe there are people who don't. As long as you can see where it is coming from and where it's going, then it's up to you to make a decision on whether or not you think that's a good idea.
Well, Liza, thank you for your call. I also want to bring in Tim from North Garden, who is concerned with lobbyists and open government. Tim, thanks for calling in.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question actually kind of plays off on what the last caller was talking about. And that is in relation to ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and how that I actually have two questions, but I wanted to ask you about what your thoughts are on ALEC and the fact that they're ghostwriting these corporations. They have member corporations and state legislatures who work together to write laws and present them as if they were the legislators' own laws being introduced into the legislature.
Okay, and Tim, let's take that one question
first.
Ginger or Megan, who wants to jump in on that one?
I'm happy to answer Tim's question. Sounds like a great story for a newspaper to sink their teeth in to and to write about. But I will tell you from my experience in Virginia politics and also a little bit on the national scene, rarely do legislators come up with the idea for legislation. Primarily, this is because a constituent has brought it to them, because a business or a corporation in their community has brought the issue to them. Then legislative services drafts the language. Most of the time, I think I heard this year 90% of the legislation in our assembly, and there's about 2,300 bills, was drafted by legislative services. But it is usually from a constituent, either a person or business or corporation that
local government.
Our local government that asks for the legislation.
Right.
Tim, I want you to hang on for a second because I just want to see if we can bring some more callers in. This is Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. And if you do want to join our conversation, it's 1-866-611-NEWS. That's 1-866-611-6397. And Tim, you had a second question about this issue of lobbyists or special interest groups effectively writing the legislation. Go ahead. What's your second question?
And just want to comment just on what your guest just said. The only exception with these laws that are written through ALEC is that it's a nationwide push, you know, where you have laws like the anti-immigration laws that are popping up all across the country, and they're being introduced into states one at a time. Here in Virginia, there are 29 ALEC laws that are suspected. You know, nobody knows that they're ALEC because nobody, you talk about transparency, nobody knows that these laws are written with these business interests behind them. And, you know, some of the biggest ones, you know, like Walmart and Verizon, are all members of ALEC. And then my second question was about VPAP, which you were talking about. And it's ironic because I was just studying about VPAP when I turned on the radio and you guys were talking about it. And what I noticed is that their board of directors are composed of a bunch of lobbyists. Do you find that strange?
Who wants to take that one, Megan or Ginger?
Well,
Megan.
I'll weigh in here. There are quite a few lobbyists on that board, and in part because lobbyists do use the service in the same way that the public does. They want to know who's representing who, who's giving money to whom. I have to register as a lobbyist, as does Ginger here. Anytime that we try to weigh in on legislation on a regular basis, that means that we have to lobby with the state corporation, state Secretary of State. And I hated that notion at first because I had much the same thought of that lobbyists are just special interests, that they just want what they want. They don't want, they don't have the public good in mind. But it is all part of the First Amendment right to petition the government for a redress of grievances. And while ALEC has captured the attention of a lot of people right now, I would suggest to him that this has been going on by all kinds of interest groups for years and years and years, whether that group is the Sierra Club or whether it's ALEC or whether it is a group that wants to promote abortion rights or pro-life movements. Is there are national organizations. They get together. They have ideas about how they might advance their agenda, and then they start working in the various state legislatures. And then once the state one state legislature, an idea might catch on, and then there are associations of other state legislatures, and they get ideas from them. So it's like anything else. Information breeds ideas and further information.
So the clock is conspiring against us. We've only got about 2 minutes left in the show. But George from Wise County, if you can make your question quick, please go ahead.
I think something that would be helpful economically is for the government to put all the information in one place and the newspapers get together and they can go to that information, they can share that information. The state could use the bureaucracy that's already in place to get that information available and whatnot, and the papers could get among themselves and decide to send one liberal reporter to one conservative reporter. It would serve, I think, everyone if it were done in that wise. Thank you.
George, thank you very much. 1 minute left. One really quick last word from you, Ginger Stanley.
I think that the process that we all live by during January, February, March in Virginia is a good one. Legislators take a lot of heat back home for the so-called parties, etc. But I can tell you they are hardworking, dedicated, and for the most part, their heart is in the right place.
Ginger Stanley of the Virginia Press Association, thank you for joining us. Also, Megan Ryan of the Virginia Coalition on Open Government. Pity about that clock. So much more to discuss. I'm Melinda Wittstock. Next week, be sure to tune in for the Senate Democratic and GOP leaders, Donald McKeegan, Tommy Norman. Thank you for listening tonight. Good night.
Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org. And by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.